Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 5th of February. We will continue listening to Tenton's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146 Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Tashidele, and welcome to the series of programs on developing the mind that wishes to gain enlightenment to be of the greatest benefit to all beings, the mind we call bodhicitta. Because its focus is the welfare, both temporal and ultimate, of all beings, bodhicitta is very vast. And so any action done with bodhicitta as its motivation builds a very powerful positive potential in our minds. As the text we are following, Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, says, we praise someone who gives a little food that will last half a day to a beggar. So how much more worthy is a deed that has the well-being of all living creatures at heart? So now, before we continue with the text, let's think about our motivation for participating in the program today and try to make that motivation bodhicitta. If we do, then even if the program is interrupted, the positive potential will be great. But if dedicating to all beings is too much for you, at least think that the program will be a cause for your own enlightenment and isn't just something to have on the radio to fill the silence or be a background to all your other activities. Thank you. Now back to Shantideva's text. And if you were with us over the last few programs, you will remember that he has been talking about death a lot. In Buddhism, the meditations on death and impermanence are very important, because if we don't contemplate impermanence, we very easily fall into the trap of thinking that things and people have some sort of inherent permanent essence of their own. We then believe that they should behave in a certain way. Then when they don't, we become upset and do all sorts of actions that cause us problems in the future. So Shantideva warns us that death is actually very close to us all the time, and that we can never be sure when it will grip us in its icy grasp and take us away to who knows where. If we don't make preparations now, we will have nothing to take with us on the trip we have to go on willy-nilly. In particular, Shantideva thinks back on all the harmful actions he created with the realization that they have left some ugly imprints on his mind that will inevitably bring him suffering in the future. Regretting not only the actions that he knows he has done, but also all those he infers from previous lives, he confesses and vows not to do them again. He turns to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for help, not as physical saviors who can deliver him to heaven's doorstep, but as teachers and guides who can lead him to enlightenment. And that is where we got to in our last program. The verse we were discussing was the 47th of the second chapter, and it goes like this. Therefore, I now seek refuge in the Buddhas who protect the world, who strive to shelter all that lives, and with great strength eradicate all fears. As I said last time, when you put your trust in someone, you have to be sure of the qualities of that person and their capacity to help you. Most Buddhists will know of the disciple of the Buddha called Angulimala, whose previous teacher had told him to kill 1,000 people, cut off their thumbs, and make a garland of them to hang around his neck. Putting your trust in such a person and expecting to gain happiness is a huge mistake. It's like putting your trust in a demon whose only intention is to harm you. Angulimala was very fortunate to meet the Buddha and give up his mistaken ways for the Dharma, because if he hadn't, who knows where he would be now. But because he followed the Buddha, he became an arhat in that very life, even though he earlier had been very close to collecting his 1,000th thumb. Even the Buddha told his followers to weigh his teachings very carefully before accepting them and not to follow them just because he said so. And so when we entrust ourselves to the Buddhas, as Shantideva does in his verse, we have to know all about what a Buddha is and what he or she can do. We started talking about this last Sunday, and I said a teacher should mainly have four qualities. The first is that the teacher should be a conqueror of what we call the four demons. The second is that the teacher should be free of all fear and also know precisely how to lead others to that same state of freedom. The third quality is that the teacher has love and compassion for all beings, irrespective of what or who they are. And the fourth is that no matter what others do to the teacher, he or she wishes to benefit all impartially. That means a Buddha will help those who revere him and those who scorn or even try to harm him in exactly the same way. He does not discriminate between those who benefit him and those who do the opposite. Last week, we ended the program by explaining what is meant by the four demons that a valid teacher has to overcome. The demons of death, the afflictions, the contaminated aggregates, and the son of the gods. These may not sound like our conventional idea of demons as you might find in so many horror movies nowadays, but they bring us just as much suffering as any demons that a filmmaker can dream up. The most obvious aspect of the demon of death is, of course, that which robs us of our life and everything we hold dear, and so we are naturally fearful of it. But death is just one aspect of an ongoing experience that we continually fight against, and which is the real demon, that's impermanence, the fact that everything is undergoing constant change. We long to be secure, to feel that we live in safety, but no matter what we do, we can never fulfill that longing and establish a real security and safety. We want things to be settled and permanent, so we enter relationships, build houses and careers and families. But the reality is that we and everything about us are part of a continual flux that is never still, not even for an instant. Nothing we establish is sure. Even as it is created, it changes, disintegrates, and falls apart. And we are left miserable. But we don't learn the lesson. We just start up all over again, building another relationship, another nest, another fantasy that we hope will this time bring the stability we so long for. We're dancing on quicksand. Our only hope is to give up the fantasy and embrace the reality. Give up even the ideas of stability and security and just live in the flow and with the flow. This is what the Buddha taught and what he found. Life is not annihilated. Life and death are just part of the endless flow, the continual process. And so he gave up everything and learned to ride the flux. Only then, when he was really able to give up everything, his family, his palace, his comforts, his very life, did he find the path to peace. So that is how he conquered the demon of death and how he shows us to do it. The demon of the afflictions refers to the negative emotions like anger, hatred, arrogance, attachment, and so on that causes ongoing misery. Or, as Pema Chodron says, it is our addiction to negative patterns of behavior. Like drug addicts who know that smack cocaine is bad for them but still ingest it again and again, we know that the negative afflictions will cause us harm, but we resort to them again and again as cures for our unhappiness. But it's hopeless because they will never bring us the resolution we wish for. The afflictions and our addiction to them only makes matters worse. For instance, we are convinced that anger and aggression will get us what we want, even if it's a minor victory over the person we're having a silly argument with. But that aggression just feeds the demon of the afflictions and will be reflected back at us 100-fold. Therefore, the Buddha has so trained his mind that none of these afflictions arise anymore, nor will they ever do so again. He has totally given up any involvement, never mind addiction, with them, for he sees the great damage that they do. And as he said, it's better to conquer yourself than to win 1,000 battles. Then the victory is yours. It cannot be taken from you, not by angels or by demons, heaven or hell. The demon of the contaminated aggregates is our clinging to the ordinary body and mind that we are so eager to protect in our lives. The aggregates are the body-mind collection that makes us up, and which is defiled by the wrong view, afflictions, and karma that goes with them. I gave a brief list of the aggregates in our last program. There are form, feelings, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Of course, we will find many states of mind if we look closely at ourselves, but they're all included under compositional factors. Feelings and discrimination are just two of the mental factors, but are regarded as special in our human experience and are so singled out. It is our aggregate's defilement by the afflictive emotions and karma that makes our body and experiences so difficult to bear. The Buddha also has aggregates, but not defiled by the afflictions. His aggregates are pure, and consequently, they're not a source of torment for him. And then finally, the demon of the son of the gods is the tempter that is always luring us to enjoy samsaric pleasures at the expense of gaining enlightenment. It can be found in our craving for comfort and convenience, our longing for peace and security, and our continual chase after pleasurable sensations. However, trying to satisfy such cravings has been described as licking honey off a razor's edge. For unless we are very skilled, it only leads to pain and misery, like the slashed tongue after we've been foolish enough to dip it into the honey. Actually, it is said that the time we are beset by difficulties is the best time to practice the Buddha's teachings. In his book, Mindfulness in Plain English, Venerable Henipola Gunaratna writes some excellent advice. View all problems as challenges, he says. Look upon negativities that arise as opportunities to learn and to grow. Don't run from them. Condemn yourself or bury your burden in your saintly silence. You have a problem? Great. More grist for the mill. Rejoice. Dive in and investigate. This is undoubtedly what the Buddha did on his path to the omniscient mind, and it led him to realizing the transience and lack of any inherent characteristic of all things. He was able to give up attachment to everything. That freed his mind from both the afflictions and the karma, and so when Mara sent his daughters to tempt him in his final meditation, he was able to stay calm and unmoved, and those alluring maidens were forced to reveal their true nature, ghost-like, ephemeral, and without a single iota of true existence. The demon of the son of the gods is powerless against such an enlightened one. So, if we're going to put our trust in someone who will surely lead us in the right direction, this triumph over the four so-called demons is one of the things we will have to look for. Our teacher must have no fear of uncertainty, impermanence, and death. Be completely free of the afflictive emotions. Have pure aggregates and not be affected by pleasurable temptations. Then, in addition, such a person must not only be free of fear himself, but must also be able to clearly show others how they too can be free. An ordinary person like myself might know a smidgen of Dharma, but without clairvoyance cannot know exactly what another person needs for enlightenment and freedom from fear. The Buddha can see into others' minds and so knows exactly what they need, even though they themselves might think they require something else. But not only does the Buddha know what they need, he's omniscient, and is also very skilled at providing it to them. He is thus very powerful in being able to both read others and direct them on the way to overcoming fear. Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism, said that the Buddha was the right protector of the world because he explained how dependent origination overcomes ignorance. In other words, how everything is dependent on other things, which in turn are dependent on others, and so on. Essentially, everything depends on everything else, and nothing has its own independent inherent existence. But this is not our normal perception. We think everything and everyone exist independently, and so react with emotional involvement. Only when we really understand the wisdom of interdependence and the lack of independence will we be free from fear, and the Buddha having already completely understood how reality truly exists, has the power to show us how to get this wisdom. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that this wisdom must be accompanied by a sense of love and compassion. I myself feel and also tell other Buddhists that the question of nirvana will come later, he has said. There's not much hurry. If in day-to-day life you lead a good life, honesty, with love, with compassion, with less selfishness, then automatically it will lead to nirvana. And that leads to the third characteristic of a valid guide. He or she should have equal compassion for all beings. His Holiness says that when Shantideva claims that the Buddha looks to shelter all that lives and eradicate all fears, he's talking of beings both caught in samsara and in the absolute peace of the arhats. We must remember here that Shantideva is teaching us how to become a bodhisattva, and that means not stopping practicing when we become free from samsara and will never again experience any more suffering. That is what the arhats do. Once out of the endless round of cyclic existence, they settle in and remain at peace indefinitely. But bodhisattvas are not only concerned with their own ultimate well-being, they want all others to gain peace as well. Their compassion is such that they must continually work until they have the ultimate power, the omniscient mind, which cognizes everything as it is purely. This combination of great compassion and ultimate knowledge and wisdom is their best weapon to liberate others from their afflictions, as well as the subtle imprints left on their minds by the afflictions. So the compassion that we look for in a great teacher is a compassion that is concerned for all beings until they reach the ultimate state of Buddhahood. And finally, the Buddhas are not concerned with helping only those who profess themselves to be Buddhists and make thousands of offerings every day. Buddhas help everyone in whatever way they can. The Buddha is not a Buddhist. If it would be most beneficial that a Buddha appears to teach as Jesus Christ or Allah, he or she will do so. Whether the followers of those masters have paid respect to the Buddhas in the past or reviled and criticized them. The Buddha's love and compassion are completely unconditional, and so the Buddhas don't choose between whom they will help or don't help. That doesn't mean to say that Buddhas can and will help everyone equally. If there is little or no positive karmic connection between a Buddha and an ordinary being, the Buddha may not be able to be much help at all. The most obvious example of this is Devadatta, Buddha's half-brother, who was so jealous that he actually tried to kill the Buddha on a few occasions. Although the Buddha had no animosity towards Devadatta and truly wanted to benefit him, he could do very little, because Devadatta was so filled with negative attitudes and emotions towards him. The karmic connection between them, well, at least from Devadatta's side, just blocked any good the Buddha might have done for his half-brother. So in this verse, when Shantideva seeks refuge in the Buddha, he's putting his trust in a mind that has these four extraordinary qualities. Pema Chodron, in her commentary on this text, implies that we don't necessarily put our ultimate trust in a person, but in the enlightened mind itself that has these qualities. In the end, our trust is really on our own capacity to awaken to this enlightened mind. Even though the Buddha is enlightened, he does not have any power other than that of teaching to enlighten us. We must have the faith in our own enlightened mind to do the work necessary to make it shine out. Nobody can do that work for us, no matter how many prayers and supplications we make. So then Shantideva puts his faith in the teachings of the Buddha in his next verse. Likewise, I purely seek refuge in the Dharma they have realized that clears away the fears of cyclic existence, and also in the assembly of bodhisattvas. Pema Chodron says about this verse that when we don't understand the teachings or the workings of cause and effect, we automatically continue to strengthen our negative tendencies. That, of course, leads to suffering in the future. But now Shantideva realizes that he is the one creating his own future, and so is inspired to practice the teachings, especially those that lead to bodhicitta and becoming a bodhisattva. His practice of the teachings is what protects him, for it transforms his negative tendencies, strengthens the positive, and builds new beneficial imprints on his mind. He can go into the future with confidence, clear of the fears of cyclic existence. I, trembling with fear, offer myself to Samantabhadra, to Manja Ghosha also, I make a gift of my body. To the protector Avalokiteshvara, who infallibly acts with compassion, I utter a mournful cry, please protect this evildoer. In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart for Akashagarbha, Ktigarbha, and all the compassionate protectors. And I seek refuge in Vajrapani, upon the sight of whom all harmful beings, such as the messengers of death, flee in terror to the four quarters. Previously I transgressed your advice, but now upon seeing this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this fear be swiftly cleared away. This may sound like Shantideva is asking all these bodhisattvas to save him from his fear, as though they can physically remove him from the results of his negative karma. However, we have to understand what these names stand for to really understand where he's going. Each of the protectors he evokes stands for a particular quality of the enlightened state, realizing reality, or a quality of that reality itself. For instance, when he says in verse 49, I, trembling with fear, offer myself to Samantabhadra, to Manja Ghosha also I make a gift of my body, he's talking about representations. Samantabhadra is sometimes called the primordial Buddha and represents timeless awareness. Dzongkhar Khyentse Rinpoche describes it like this. Samantabhadra is not subject to time and space or physical conditions, is not a colored being with two eyes, etc. Samantabhadra is the unity of awareness and emptiness, appearance and clarity with unceasing compassion. That is Samantabhadra from the very beginning. And Manja Ghosha, or perhaps more commonly Manjushri, is the representation of all the Buddha's wisdom. So Shantideva is giving himself over not as a slave to some other worldly beings, but to the states of ultimate awareness beyond space and time, and the wisdom recognizing the lack of inherent independent nature of phenomena. Realizing these is the ultimate protection, for one with such a realization has transcended samsara and is so well beyond the sufferings that we are caught up in. In verse 50, Shantideva says, to the protector Avalokiteshvara, who infallibly acts with compassion, I utter a mournful cry. Please protect this evildoer. Again, this is not a cry for physical rescue, but a commitment to Avalokiteshvara, or in Tibetan Chenrezig, the embodiment of all the Buddha's compassion. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is reputedly an embodiment of Chenrezig, and Chenrezig is like the patron saint of Tibetans. When I was in India living with the Tibetans, the older people all wandered about saying mantras and counting on their malas or rosaries. Mostly, they were chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, the mantra of Chenrezig. The power of the mantra is demonstrated by one Tibetan woman, now old, who was very beautiful in her youth. Because of her beauty, she was chased by a wealthy man with such influence that he could rarely demand that she marry him. She escaped him by climbing down a hole in a cliff that served as a toilet and running away to a monastery where she went into retreat in a tiny hut of one room. There she stayed for 45 years, not seeing anyone except the person who brought her food and the doctor occasionally. Then fairly recently, Matthew Ricard, the great photographer, philosopher, monk, known as the happiest man in the world, and one or two others visited her hut and surprisingly spoke to her. Just as they were leaving, she said words to Matthew Ricard to the effect, it's great all that monastic stuff you guys do, and I respect it, and it's quite wonderful. But you know, it really just comes down to a single mantra. She told Ricard, who speaks Tibetan, that she deeply prays for all sentient beings to be free of all outer and inner sufferings, and from her heart dedicates the merit to them as she recites the Avalokiteshvara mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. The mantra is, the old woman claimed, like the one Dharma that condenses all. And then she got quite profound. All Buddha's teachings are directed to understanding the nature of mind, she said. Ultimately, we have to give up all elaborate practices and simply remain in Buddha nature and Buddha mind. If it only it were so easy. A video of the visit to the old woman is on YouTube, and you'll get to it if you type Buddhist nun speaks after 45 years of solitary retreat into YouTube search window. The URL is too complicated, so as I said, search for Buddhist nun speaks after 45 years of solitary retreat. Attaining the Buddha mind is what Shantideva is pointing to with the verses we are studying. For the protectors he's invoking are all aspects of the enlightened mind. Going to Avalokiteshvara for refuge is like putting your trust in the compassion of the Buddha mind and practicing according to that. Of course, if you have compassion for all other sentient beings, you try your best not to harm them, but to bring them happiness. Even developing that attitude without any explicit actions while sitting in a one-room hut in the middle of nowhere brings enormous benefits. Then in calling himself an evildoer, Shantideva recognizes that in the past he has acted without compassion and without love for others. Thinking only of his own interests, he harmed others and took advantage of them. Now recognizing how that kind of behavior leads inevitably to suffering results, he turns his mind to ultimate compassion and from now on promises to only act with compassion for others. In the next verse he writes, "In my search for refuge, I cry from my heart for Akashagarbha, Kitsigarbha, and all the compassionate protectors." Akashagarbha represents boundless space and infinite meritorious actions, like a billionaire opening his vast wealth to benefit the poor. And Kitsigarbha, otherwise known as the Earth Store Buddha, represents the compassion that vowed to stay in the hells and not become enlightened until they were all empty. So these are the kinds of minds that Shantideva is now putting his trust in. Then in the next two verses, he seeks refuge in Vajrapani, the embodiment of all the power of all the Buddhas. In the Gelug sect of Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrapani is grouped with Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri in a trio representing the compassion, wisdom, and power of all the Buddhas. From Shantideva, we can see where the tradition for such a grouping comes from. He writes, "And I seek refuge in Vajrapani, upon the sight of whom all harmful beings, such as the messengers of death, flee in terror to the four quarters. Previously I transgressed your advice, but now seeing this with this great fear, I go to you for refuge. By doing so, may this fear be swiftly cleared away." In the Tibetan tradition, all these protectors that Shantideva is invoking take on various forms as meditational deities, some to our Western eyes quite weird. You may think when you visit a Tibetan monastery or temple that the pictures known as tankas hanging on the walls are very strange, some even demonic. But Tibetans are not demon worshippers. The fierce and fiery representations are meant to convey the powerful forces guided by wisdom that are able to defeat the afflictions that cause us so much trouble. When we align our minds with such forces with pure bodhicitta attitude, we enhance the power of our own minds to overcome our personal demons and attain enlightenment. And we also develop much greater powers to benefit those who turn to us for help. This is how the fear Shantideva talks about will be swiftly cleared away. And now, once again, time is up. Please dedicate any positive energy from this program to the enlightenment of all beings, which, of course, includes yourself. I've been invited to a monastery in Darwin for a month to 6 weeks, so from the 30th of March, the program will be going to recess until I return. I apologize for any inconvenience this may cause. Thank you for joining the program today, and I hope you'll do so again next week. Goodbye.